access number 14206, Reel 2.
Spencer Cox, Reel 2. Do you know if your pamphlets were acted upon? You know, the...
Well, it's hard to say. The National Planning Association wasn't the only organization interested in these things, and of course, the pamphlet stressed the need for a United Nations effort. This was before the United Nations was actually formed, but I remember the thrust of the pamphlets was that the United States should not do it all, should not try to do it alone. It should be part of the United Nations effort. And I don't know how much influence what I was doing or what the National Planning Association was doing had. But a lot of the things that we were advocating, like a large-scale United Nations effort, were put into effect. But it's like, the sun doesn't necessarily come up because the rooster crows.
Well, what were the attitudes of other people to you? I mean, for instance, would they have known you were a conscientious?
Oh, yes. A lot of people did. When I went around Washington talking to officials from the government, I said that I was on the staff of the National Planning Association, which was true. And I wasn't asked any questions, usually. I don't think most of the people that I dealt with in that capacity necessarily knew that I was a conscience objector, and I didn't throw it in their faces. Sometimes, of course, it came up, and I ran into a certain amount of hostility, but really very little.
Would you say that was pretty general? You know, for instance, when you were in the forest, cutting down the trees.
Nobody saw us except the birds.
How about, you know, did you not come into contact with anyone in the neighborhood?
No, I was in this camp in the forest for only 6 weeks, and it was about 45 miles from my home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My parents were living in Cambridge then. So I used to go home when I could get out of camp on weekends and so on. I didn't hang around Ashburnham, Massachusetts. I went back home to Cambridge. So I had absolutely no contact with any of the locals near the camp.
Right, so now I'm going to ask you about China. You know, obviously you've explained about the pamphlet you were writing about China, so
yes,
your interest is apparent. But how about the Friends Ambulance Unit? You know, what had you heard about that?
Well, before, as I say, before Pearl Harbor and before I got drafted, I had hoped to work overseas for the Friends Service Committee. And in fact, what I was doing at Pendle Hill was getting... taking some courses that they had specially set up there for a small group of young men and women who the service committee was hoping to send overseas. And in fact, my alleged assignment was going to be Shanghai, working with Jewish refugees there. And so I was kind of groomed ahead of time to go overseas. What was your question again?
It was really the Friends Ambulance Unit.
Oh,
if you knew anything about...
Yeah, well, I'd heard about the Friends Ambulance Unit, of course. As my days of conscription came to an end, I told the American Friends Service Committee that I still wanted to do overseas work, even after I got demobilized. And at that time, they were recruiting people to join the FAU, which, of course, was largely a British organization. And I guess during the war, and certainly at the end of the war, the Friends Service Council in England and the American Friends Service Committee in the United States in Philadelphia shared responsibility for running the Friends Ambulance Unit. That is, for finding staff, for finding recruits to go there, for and for financing it. So it was by 1942, when I went out, it was really the FAU was a joint undertaking of the American and British Friends. And I guess when I got there in early February of 42, the unit must have had about maybe 150 people in it, and I guess half of them anyway were British or English. And then there was a bunch of New Zealanders and quite a few Canadians and Americans, but I think the majority were still British.
This is when you got to where?
To Shanghai.
Oh.
I was one of the first people in the FAU to get to China across the Pacific Ocean. I was on a troop ship, actually, taking American troops to Japan to occupy Japan. And I was crammed in with thousands of soldiers and sailors on their way to Japan. And then the ship went on from Tokyo, from Yokohama to Shanghai, where I got off.
So how did you, when you arrived in Shanghai, how did you relate to the Friends Ambulance Unit?
Well, I was a member of it.
Yes, but no, but I wonder what you thought of it as an organization.
Well, it's a strange organization to walk into. They were, well, in the first place, most of the people were English, and I suppose there was a residual. I think there was just a bit of feeling among a lot of the English members that the Americans were interlopers. And it was never overt, and it didn't cause me any discomfort. But the style, the group in Shanghai was very small. Shanghai was not the center of the administrative center of the FAU, and we had a small kind of hostel there with maybe 10 people in it who were variously employed, largely arranging for supplies to be brought in and so on, now that Shanghai was open. So it was a small group and very closely knit. And I liked them right away. Although one of my first encounters was with a very bleak and forbidding-looking Englishman whose name I will not mention. And he looked me over more or less as I got off the ship. Oh, and I must tell you, I arrived on the ship with 15 tons of K-rations, which the Navy on this ship had been carrying back and forth across the ocean, and they didn't know what to do with them. And when I discovered this, I said, well, give them, could I telegraph our office in Shanghai to see whether they would like these rations? And the commander of the ship said, no, we don't allow civilians to telegraph, but you'll have to tell me right now, yes or no, does your group want these K rations? So I said, well, yes. So I arrived in Shanghai, and of course everybody was astonished when I said, well, there are 15 tons of K rations plus maybe 100 bales of blankets and other things which I have procured for the unit. So anyway, when this bleak Englishman heard that I'd arrived in China with 15 tons of K rations. He said, probably the only good thing you'll do all the time you're out here. But except for that, except for that rather negative note at the beginning, everything was fine, and I just felt this is the place for me.
What stage of the sort of civil war situation would that have been?
Well, 1946, in 1946, the communists were holed up in the north, pretty much holed up in the northwest in Yan'an. And although they had guerrilla areas here and there throughout North China, they were small areas, and the nationalists were in control of almost everything. And I think that very few people realized how short a lease on life the nationalists had. But at that time, the country was firmly in the control of Chiang Kai-shek.
Do you think your sort of analysis of the situation in the paper that you had drafted back in the States about relief in China, were you sort of spot on?
I think it was not bad, considering I didn't know what I was writing about. I don't remember, really. I don't really remember trying to make a comparison of what I saw and what I'd written. But I think that, I can't really answer that question.
And what was your particular work, how did you relate to this sort of unit? What was
your
role?
They didn't really know what to do with me very much. I'm sure you know, the major work of the unit was either transport or medical. And I'm totally hopeless when it comes to anything mechanical. And I know nothing about medicine. So the only thing I was good for was administrative work. The first thing they did was to send me up, after just a few days, really, in Shanghai, they sent me up to Honan province, which is in the north-central part of the country, that had been terribly devastated by the war, by an enormous flood. And there was an organization there called the Honan International Relief Committee, which was a kind of a clearinghouse of various agencies, largely church groups, which were trying to do relief work in that province. And I was acting as the secretary of that group, finding out from the different church organizations, particularly, and UNRWA and SINRA, which was a Chinese counterpart to UNRWA, finding out what the needs of various relief projects that these different organizations had set up, and trying to apportion what monies were available and supplies among these organizations. So I was doing administrative work from the beginning, and I was in Honan for a year, and then the unit chose me as its chairman, and I had to move to Shanghai, and I was really very sorry to go. I love the country out there, and Shanghai is a unpleasant and really not interesting city at all. Well, interesting, everything's interesting, but it was not, it's a kind of an excrescence, on China. And so I spent my last year and a half at the headquarters. By that time, the unit headquarters had moved to China, to Shanghai, and I spent my last year and a half there pushing papers around, dealing with budgets and dealing with the home offices in London, and Philadelphia about money and about recruits and supplies and so on.
Yes. The impression one gets sometimes from the American side is that it was the American Friends Service Committee who were mostly involved in the China.
Oh, no. Reception. No, no.
Am I not right in thinking that?
Well, maybe.
The publicity.
Well, I guess I think that the... one of my jobs when I was out there, of course, was to send reports to Philadelphia and to London about what we were doing. And I think that the publicity that the Friends, that the American Friends Service Committee put out, certainly while I was in China, was very accurate in stating that this program was the program of the Friends Ambulance Unit, which was a joint undertaking of British and American Friends.
Yes, but was it also, you know, apart from being British and American, did it have a genuine sort of international
aspect? Oh, yes. We had a lot of Chinese members, and they were absolutely indispensable, of course. It's hard to give you any accurate statistics, and of course the mixture changed from time to time. I think when I went out there, probably well over half the members were British, and by the time I had left, the majority were American, but there were also, I think when I went out there, there were as many Canadians as there were Americans. The Canadians always played a very, quite a prominent role in the unit. And there was always a New Zealand contingent, 8 or 10. When I went out there, there must have been 8 or 10 New Zealanders. Never any Australians. I don't know why not.
Well, what sort of assessment would you give to the work of the Friends Ambulance Unit from what you saw, from your own experience, the work that they did in Shanghai and Hunan? That would have been your main experience, wouldn't it?
Yes. I did not see any of the transport work in the West, which I think probably had more practical significance than some of the work in the East, because there was so little transport, and I think the transport work was probably very effective. I think a lot of our hospital work in the East and the North was good. We opened up hospitals, the missionary hospitals that had been closed since the Japanese invasion, we sent teams of doctors and nurses and lab technicians and medical mechanics in and opened up these hospitals before the missionaries came back. I think our village rehabilitation work in this little village of Jungmu was probably not terribly effective in the long run. The hospital work certainly was. The medical team, the teams that we sent into communist territory, I think were very significant. when our first team went into Yan'an, for instance, I guess we were the only group of medical personnel from outside. There were a few individual doctors, like the famous Dr. Haydam, Dr. Mahaida, who was a European. But we had a whole medical team there, and I think that this was important because it showed the communist government there that there were groups of people who were concerned about medical problems. But you know, the I think honestly, to answer your question in broad terms, what any small group like the Friends Ambulance Unit could do in a in a country as immense as China with overwhelming problems doesn't loom very large. I mean, we opened up 15 hospitals, but what's 15 hospitals in a country of a billion people, you know? I think the work we did was good, but our work in the communist territory, I think, was a good demonstration that there were people of goodwill in the West who were interested in service that transcended political differences. But faced with the Cold War and the overwhelming hostility of the West toward China and the fact that China was made the enemy and the whipping boy, faced with that, our efforts didn't turn the tide at all, and it's really hard to honestly say that they made much difference. And of course this is distressing. All of us who worked out there saw that the days of the nationalist government were over, and that sooner or later the West would have to come to terms with the communists. And to see our government, particularly the American government, bent on exacerbating the hostilities, was able to make an enemy, despite what feeble efforts we might make to show friendship. This was very distressing.
Did you yourself have anything to do with the medical team that went to Yan'an?
Well, I had something to do with it. I didn't do the negotiating. I didn't have much directly to do with it, but I was in the headquarters office, and I guess I had a hand in choosing who should go in. Well, I was part of that. We were a very democratic group, as you can imagine. And the fact that I had the title chairman of the unit didn't mean that I was any kind of a dictator. The organization was very, very democratically run. But I had something to do with choosing the people, and I had a lot to do, of course, with helping get supplies from England and the United States. All that went through the office in Shanghai. So I was part of the paper pushing component of that.
How worrying was it, you know?
What did you say?
How worrying was it when the team were in Yan'an and then the Kuomintang attacked that area and they then had to leave? Were you kept abreast with it?
Well, no, we weren't. We went weeks and weeks without hearing from them because there was no way of getting messages through. The communist government always had the Yan'an government always had an office in Hong Kong. And as I recall, we did have some liaison that way. And I think we felt that if anything awful happened, the Hong Kong office of the communist government would know and would tell us. And of course we were concerned when we went weeks and weeks without hearing from them. But we were a very Most people in the unit were very adventurous people and very self-reliant. And from the beginning, members of the unit had been in difficult and risky situations. It was part of the game, really. And we were not sitting there biting our fingernails every minute. But of course we were concerned. We had one very difficult and trying experience. The father, he was an American, the father of one of the members of our Yan'an team came out to China on the false assumption that his daughter, who he knew was up there, would be coming out of communist territory and would be ready to go home. And he turned up in Shanghai and in effect said, "Where's my daughter?" I won't mention any names. And we said, "We don't know where she is. She's up there somewhere with the team. Well, I want to get a message to her." Well, there's no way of doing it. And he was very, very difficult. And he hung around driving us all nuts for about 3 weeks. And finally, she did come. I think he waited until she came out. And then she just appeared. No, he didn't. He finally gave up. He finally realized that China was not America, and that there were no railroads and no postal service, and that he couldn't do anything. So he finally gave up, but he drove us all absolutely crazy. And he was more of a worry to us than the people on the team.
Did you find that, you know, after your sort of lone CO job, as it were, in America, that it was good to be part of a unit of like-minded people?
Yes. Yes, I did. In fact, and I'm sure you've heard this from other people, but that unit has, there was an amazing degree of camaraderie in that unit. And we still have reunions here after, 45 years on New Year's Eve. Well, we now have them every 2 years, and people come. And I am in touch with probably in regular contact, at least through Christmas cards, and very often through more than that, with maybe 20 members of the unit, including several people in England. And my wife and I go over there to England every few years, and we always visit unit members. But I feel very, very close to maybe 20 people I I knew then, and a half a dozen of them I really consider very close friends. In America, there are people we see all the time. That's been a very, very important part of my life.
Well, Spencer, thank you very much indeed for telling me about the, you know, contact with the FAU. And if I could just ask you, you know, when the war ended, were you given the advantages that, say, the GIs were?
No.
Regarding education and...
No, we were not entitled to the GI Bill of Rights or I guess, special mortgage rates or other things. No, I don't think so.
You didn't have help when you resumed your university education?
No. We were not entitled to... Well, I'd finished that before I got drafted, so I personally didn't need educational benefits, but COs were not entitled to them. But, you know, COs during the Second War were not mistreated the way they were in the first war in this country. And I think that there was more public tolerance of COs than there was in the first war. I ran into very little hostility. Now, I think in other parts of the country it might have been worse. I think the East is probably more tolerant than the Midwest. Is that it?